Hereditary neuromuscular disorders are highly debilitating, fatal, and currently incurable muscle-wasting diseases. Affected children survive anywhere from a few months up to 3 decades and are usually wheelchair-bound by the age of 10, depending on the severity. Recent rapid advancements in genetic screening techniques have allowed us both to better understand as well as develop therapies for such genetic diseases. My DFIL focuses on two of these, namely DMD and SMA for short, as the genetic mutations causing these diseases are very well characterized, and there is an enormous potential for improvement of patient quality of life. My ultimate goal is to be able to correct these mutations at the DNA source permanently. Luckily, the wonderful, incredible, albeit mysterious era of genome engineering is upon us. And in 2012, CRISPR burst onto the scene as a novel and highly powerful gene editing technology. I have basically chosen this as it is able to... So this was developed from a bacterial adaptive immune system, and researchers since then have been able to develop the world's most effective molecular torpedo. Essentially, a sat-nav system directed by a short guide sequence that takes a molecular scissor molecule called the Cas9 to a highly specific target in the genome. Once the CRISPR editor has located this target, the Cas9 is triggered to create an incision in the DNA, which I can then leverage for my project to either cut out an entire region of mutated DNA or to insert the correct sequence into the gene in that gap, thereby restoring the gene's expression and alleviating the disease pathology. I have so far shown that this is possible in a mouse model of DMD, and I'm currently investigating applying this for SMA-causing mutations for permanent correction. While the major focus of my DFIL is for developing gene-based therapies for neuromuscular disorders, a paramount benefit is the concomitant optimization of CRISPR as a gene editing tool, as this is able to be applied to a plethora of other devastating and currently incurable human genetic diseases. Thank you.
Thank you, Britt, for your very concise summary of CRISPR. Very interesting. Right, we now have Shuzhang Cao, who is talking about implementing machine learning on quantum computers. Take it away.
Okay. So if you ask me what the greatest achievement of mankind made in the last decade, I would say deep learning. Nowadays, self-driving cars, voice recognition, and machine translation, all those popular applications are based on deep learning. However, if you look at the history of deep learning, actually the idea is not that new. So the mathematical architecture for deep learning called artificial neural network was actually invented in the 1950s. And the way we are using, we are training the artificial networks called the backpropagation was invented in the 1960s. Then why has deep learning only recently been so successful? One of the key reasons, I think, is because of the computational power. AlphaZero, I think probably everyone is very familiar with it. The famous AI beat the world Go game champion, was trained with 5,000 special devices made by Google called the Tensor Processor Unit, which is on the right. So the training process for AlphaZero is 8 hours. However, if we are going to run the same algorithms on our best supercomputer in year 2000, it would have taken around 51 years to finish the training. So computational power would make a great difference on artificial intelligence. So then what is the most powerful computer we could ever have in the near future? That is the quantum computer. Quantum mechanics follows a very complicated rules based on linear algebra, and it is very hard to simulate with a classical computer. However, if you if you think reversibly, and convert, you can convert a very hard mathematical problem into a quantum behavior and simply observe what happened in the end and ask, let the nature tell you what the answer is. That's how a quantum computer works. So in order to use a quantum computer for deep learning, we need to find the right mathematical model that will bridge the deep learning and quantum computer. So in my thesis, I investigated a mathematical model called tensor network, and if I prove it is very powerful and it can be used for machine learning and act as that bridge. And based on my result, I believe we are on the right path towards the future quantum artificial intelligence.
Perfectly on time again, although the alarm might have gone off for another reason. Oh, I couldn't hear. Right, next up we have Ellen Brewster, who's going to talk a bit more historically about 18th century readers and elocution books.
Hi, my research is about the history of reading. It's important to remember that reading is a historically specific activity, one which takes particular forms at particular times in history. Our primary mode of reading tends to be silent, even when we're surrounded by others, on our commutes or as academics in libraries. Well, in the 18th century, this kind of silence would have been highly unusual. As this picture from 1777 illustrates, 18th century people often saw reading as a raucous, loud social event. The picture shows a group of people known colloquially as spouters, performers of amateur theatre, who would read aloud from books in pubs. You take turns to read and listen to your friends. A kind of 18th century karaoke, but with less Britney and more Bard. Throughout my research, I've been trying to establish a narrative for how 18th century readers conceptualised reading aloud and what reading meant for them. I'm doing this through a comprehensive study of surviving elocution books, that is, books that taught people how to read aloud. These books were filled with tips on how to articulate yourself well, use appropriate variation in tone, and suitable accompanying gestures. These small books contained a mixture of extracts from works by popular authors at the time, like Shakespeare or Milton. So our spouter in the red coat here is reading Macbeth. He says, "Is that a dagger I see before me?" But he doesn't have a dagger, only some forceps poking out of his pocket. He's no Macbeth. We can tell he's a barber, and we can tell that from the tool in his pocket. And essentially, the argument of my thesis is this: that elocution books work to shape people's reading practices, encouraging social forms of reading that were more refined than that of our motley crew of spouters. Paradoxically, one of the key tenets of those kinds of books is that you shouldn't be over-dependent on your reading material. So the best reader of an elocution book is someone who no longer needs it. Today, I'm not being so brave. My notes, unlike an elocution book, don't have that planned obsolescence. And yet these books did. Not only did you have to be able to afford your elocution books, you also had to have the time to learn from it and then put it aside, buying a succession of new ones, sequels with new texts to read and recite. With literacy rates rapidly rising across the 18th century and book prices dropping, more people could read than ever. But as this cartoon shows, this reading was at risk of being antisocial rather than social. Our reader and his audience aren't being social at all. Pipes are broken, drinks are spilled, and most of them, unlike you lot, aren't even listening. Elocution books of this period tried to correct this tendency, encouraging good readers to also be good listeners. And I guess this point has rubbed off on me. Unlike this motley lot, I know when my time in the limelight is up, and so it's time for me to listen to someone else. Thank you.
Very eloquent. Right, next up we have Tika Mala, who's going to talk about beating tuberculosis with repurposed drugs. Take it away.
It's going to be difficult to beat Ellen, but we can definitely try beating tuberculosis. Tuberculosis, it is the leading cause of death from an infectious disease that's arising from a single microbial agent. It claims millions of new victims every year. 10.7 million cases were reported in 2017 alone. It's a tragedy in the sense that it's a curable disease that's increasingly become untreatable due to lack of compliance for the antibacterial treatment from the existing patient, as well as unnecessary use and overprescription of antibiotics. In the last 40 years, we've only had two new approval of drugs in the market. So at this rate, we're very far from beating tuberculosis. So my deal field, what it's suggesting or what it's revolving around, is looking at these different classes of beta-lactam antibiotics, out of which only one subclass has been approved or researched for treatment of tuberculosis. First thing, repurposing existing drugs saves about $2.6 billion. If you're thinking about making new drug, bringing a new drug in the market, $2.6 billion, and it takes on average about 15 to 16 years. So you're passing this hurdle if you're trying to repurpose drug and create affordable medicine. So I look at how these antibiotics interact with tuberculosis and use any new mechanism to design or direct the direction of research into making new drugs, as well as repurposing these existing drugs. So what do we target in this tuberculosis? What is the protein or what is the target area? It's a protein called LD transpeptidase. What it does is it cross-links the cell wall, that's the outer membrane of bacteria, and protects it against environmental factors such as pressure, as well as making it impermeable to antibiotics. So if we weaken this cell wall of this bacteria by targeting that protein using these beta-lactam antibiotics, we weaken them, we make them susceptible to antibiotics, and hopefully treat them. So in a nutshell, my research will look into... Thank you. In a nutshell, what we're trying to do is weaken the outer cell of this bacteria and then kill them, basically, and then get new drugs or use the repurposed drugs to treat this tuberculosis. So what I'm proposing is using old drugs or making new one as I go along as a concomitant effect. Thank you, everyone. Any questions?
Now we have Sam Peters, who's talking about the reintegration of former girl soldiers in Democratic Republic of Congo, the impact of discourse.
As you can see, I've got some maps up here, which I think are quite useful for the context of my talk. So this is the DRC. As you can see, it's the size of Western Europe, which is quite crucial, something to bear in mind. And on the right of the map, you can see these various militia groups, all except the M23, which are no longer in existence. So I think that the first point that I'd like to try and get across with what I've been researching is the complexity and the scale of the issue. DRC, just by the size, the geographical size, is hugely varied. There are a dozen or so ethnic tribes within the region, each with their own beliefs, each with their own ethnic affiliations to other groups within the country or to those around the periphery. Since the late 1990s, there's been an ongoing conflict, largely supported by Uganda and Rwanda over to the east. And a lot of that has been to do with the mineral resources of the country. Unfortunately, the conflict has generally been oversimplified in academic and policy appraisals. And I wanted to examine that within the sphere of child reintegration, children being used in armed groups, and more specifically, girls. The academic literature and the policy literature on girls is still quite limited. They are viewed in quite a specific way as being pure victims of sexual abuse. The Congo has been linked quite consistently with the idea of sexual violence. Margot Wallstrom, a UN representative, famously called it the rape capital of the world. And the country has kind of inhabited this discourse of being a depraved, inhumane heart of darkness ever since then. The question is whether these discourses, which are widely circulated in the West, are seriously undermining efforts to reintegrate girl soldiers. And my research, conducted over a couple of weeks in Goma, eastern Congo, North Kivu, showed that girls actually occupy a number of roles. Some of them are combatants. Many of them actually find their time in armed groups to be beneficial. That sounds perhaps slightly twisted, but in a sense, due to endemic poverty outside the group, they have more opportunity. They will return to groups even after reintegration due to lack of opportunity. And many actually are given preferential treatment within the groups. So challenging this discourse on their victim status is incredibly important for our policy in reintegrating them. And it shows that perhaps we need to have a different approach in how we the conflict and how it's presented for within the Congo. Thank you.
Next up, we have Razia Chowdhury, who's going to talk about making artificial cells for therapeutic drug delivery.
Majority of medicines are made in a way to which are made of small molecules. Small molecules such as paracetamol or penicillin. But now biotechnology is trying to develop a new way of producing therapy, which are one of them is proteins. Now, proteins have been already used in many types of diseases, such as cancer, as well as diabetes, and anemia, heart disease, and so on. Now, proteins are great to use because they are a powerful type of therapeutic. They are much better than small molecules. Proteins, however, do have their advantages, which disadvantages, which is that they are large, they're very fragile, and they need to work in a three-dimensional structure for them to carry out the functions that they need to carry out. So the problem is you can't just inject them into the bloodstream and expect them to basically do their work. They need to be delivered into the target site in the correct way. So this is what my PhD is about. It's about trying to create a system to deliver therapeutic proteins into a target site, for example, a tumor, without actually causing a toxic effect on healthy tissues, just attacking the tumor. How am I doing this? I'm doing this by creating artificial cells. Artificial cells is a form of simple cells. If you remember from your school time, a cell has DNA, and it has lots of other types of machinery. Now, I'm able to insert any type of DNA into that artificial cell, so we make artificial cells from scratch, and I can insert any DNA I want for it to make any type of protein that I wanted to make. So if I wanted the artificial cell to make therapeutic proteins such as insulin or a tumor suppressor, I can do that. So the way we would do this is to put that artificial cell, so this yellow bit that you see here with the mechanical system to carry out protein production, and then it will be attached to a carrier which will carry it out of the artificial cell into the synthetic tissue. The great thing about this system is that my DNA that I'm using is a type of a designer DNA, which you can only activate by shining light on it. So only this artificial cell will only produce therapeutic protein when light is shone on it. This has a huge potential in the field of medicine for controlled delivery and efficacy of therapeutic proteins at a disease site. Thank you.
A very interesting field, I'm sure we'll hear a lot about. Next, we have Louis coming up to talk about when breast milk comes second, predictive factors in pre-lactal feeding practices in Indonesia.
Hi, my name is Luri. I'm a first-year DPhil student in population health, and my project is going to be looking at the trends and determinants of pre-lactal feeding practice in my home country, which is Indonesia. We all know that breast milk is good. It contains amazing nutritional values and other health benefits, but most importantly, in developing countries like mine, it's one of the best public health interventions because it's known to reduce newborns' death and illnesses. So that's why WHO has been recommending exclusive breastfeeding, which means no food or other liquids other than breast milk for the first 6 months of life. However, exclusive breastfeeding is not easy, and one of the challenges is that this pre-lactal feeding, which is quite common in Asian countries, it means giving anything other than breast milk in the first few hours or days to the newborns before the actual mother's breast milk comes in. So it could be anything like formula, animal's milk, coconut water, like random things like honey, tea, butter, anything. And it could be for religious or cultural reason. It really varies among countries. So in a very few cases, it could be medically indicated, but mostly it's not. So when it's not, it's where it becomes harmful. So it could especially in the poor hygiene settings, it could increase the risk of contamination, which will lead to infection and, of course, disease. And it could also delay the actual breastfeeding, which means losing the benefit of the breast milk itself. So at the end of the day, it's going to be a huge economical loss to the country. So the reason I'm doing this study is because Prolactinal feeding is quite common in my country, about 40%. And and my country is huge. We have about 250 million people with thousands of tribes and ethnicity. And so it's really important to have epidemiological studies about that to evaluate and to identify the vulnerable groups. And so that's why I'm trying to understand the patterns, trend predictors, to inform the public policy. I'm going to be doing a quantitative analysis using a large data set from National Data Survey and also some qualitative data to qualitative studies to complement the bigger pictures. I hope that's easy to understand. Thank you.